Hi, listeners. If you love Undisclosed, I have two small favors to ask you. First of all, I am so excited to announce that Undisclosed has finally launched a Patreon page. Now, if you've ever wondered how you can support our work, this is finally one way you can do so. Of course, by listening to us, you support us, and we are so grateful for that. When you subscribe and give us 5-star ratings, I'm so grateful for that. But to be honest, production costs money. When you drop 2 episodes a week, it takes resources. It doesn't just take our time. It costs money. We have folks to pay in order to produce these podcasts, and we have defendants and their families counting on us to continue doing this work. So you can become a patron of Undisclosed for as little as $5 a month. All you got to do is go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod and sign up there. Now, along with feeling great about yourself because you are supporting the work of fighting for the wrongfully convicted, guess what? You also get a bonus episode. Every single month, Susan, Colin, and I will drop a bonus episode that's only for patrons, in which we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to be discussing other cases from other true crime series that we find fascinating. Now, our very first episode in the Patreon feed is all about the case at the heart of the latest season of In the Dark. We're talking about the Curtis Flowers case, and we are talking about it the way we talk about all cases undisclosed, like three lawyers looking at the facts. So if you loved the In the Dark season 2 series and you're fascinated with the Curtis Flowers case, which is ongoing, and you want to know what Susan, Colin, and I think about it, well, become a patron and check it out. And if there are other cases that you have heard about on different true crime series that you would really love to hear Susan, Colin, and I unpack, then definitely let us know. Tweet at us, post on our Facebook, send us an email, and we will definitely take a look. So check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And the second favor I'd like to ask you is this. Please support our sponsors because they support us. Check out their great products and services using the unique undisclosed codes and URLs that we provide every week so that we can keep coming back to you week after week. Thanks so much for listening. And now, here is this week's episode.
As you've probably figured out by now, there's a lot that's gone missing in this case. Things like Dennis Perry's time cards, the photo arrays done by the original investigators, the notes taken by both the GBI and the Camden County Sheriff's Office. Who knows where those records are now? And to date, every single piece of physical evidence in this case has been lost. Not just things like the glasses, which went missing before trial years and years ago. The rest of it only became lost in the past 2 years. Same goes for the trial exhibits. No one seems to know where those can be found now. But if I had a magic wand that would allow me to summon back into existence a single category of missing evidence from this case, I know exactly what I'd choose. Deputy Butch Kennedy's tape cassette recordings. Part of that is because, well, I'm making a podcast about this case, and for that reason alone, any kind of original audio is worth its weight in gold. But even putting the podcast aside, just from the standpoint of someone who's interested in investigating this case, I wish so much that those tapes were still around. I'm not even sure what all would be on those tapes. I don't know how many there are or who all was interviewed, which is part of why I want them, just to know for sure who was actually interviewed in this case. It kind of kills me to know there could be recorded interviews out there with witnesses that, based on available case files, I don't even know exist. But if we had those tapes, I think we would have a much better picture of what actually happened at Rising Daughter Baptist Church on March 11, 1985. We'd know more about the witnesses' first impressions, more details of the crime scene, and just things that the witnesses saw that, at the time, might have been overlooked or forgotten, but if we knew now, might help us to put together the whole picture. Because the women I've referred to as the church ladies, the witnesses who were there at Rising Daughter that night, they're the only witnesses that the state presented at trial, but they are far from the only witnesses that may have seen the killer, and Butch Kennedy's tapes may have helped to figure out what exactly those other witnesses saw.
Thank you. welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Dennis Perry. This is our seventh in a series of episodes about the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain in Waverly, Georgia in 1985. I'm Colin Miller, an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Robbie is out of town this week, so I'm joined by my colleague Susan Simpson.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
It's worth noting that Butch Kennedy's tapes are not the only audio recordings from this case that are no longer available. Unfortunately, there's hardly any original audio available at all. At least not now there isn't. At one point, though, there would have been quite a bit. No one seems to know where it is now, though. Claire Gilbert, the director of the Georgia Innocence Project, asked Deputy Dale Bundy about where the audio might be, and he didn't know either.
We had an intern look at this last summer, and there were, it looks on the order of about 80 different audio recordings made between the sheriff's office and the GBI. Do you know where any of those are?
No, ma'am, I don't. Before I picked up the case, I don't know anything about any recordings or whatnot. Back in those days, we didn't even have recorders that had been issued us by the sheriff's office. If we wanted a recorder, we had to go out and buy one.
In addition to the missing audio, there are a lot of interviews that were just never recorded for whatever reason. For instance, during the reopened investigation from 1998 to 2003, not a single recording was made of any witness that was potentially a witness for the state. GBI agents assigned to the case did make secret recordings of the interviews with most of the potential defense witnesses in the case, although maybe they'd be better described as semi-secret. Karen Perry, who was married to Dennis at the time of his arrest, remembers actually seeing the recorder that GBI agent Ron Rose was using during one of the interviews.
He had a clipboard. He was writing notes, but he also had a little handheld recorder, and he had it in his hand up under the clipboard. I noticed that right away. He had it in his hand, but he had his hand up under, up under the clipboard, kind of hiding it.
So what we do have are recordings of the interviews from Dennis Perry's mom and brother and stepfather and his friend Clayton's, Clayton's mom as well, all recorded in the same way that Karen Perry described. You've heard some of those recordings in earlier episodes. Those recordings, though, were exclusively made of witnesses that could potentially testify on Dennis Perry's behalf, witnesses that might be able to give him an alibi or otherwise add to the defense's case. Witnesses that could have potentially testified in the state's behalf were never recorded, which is why we don't have recorded interviews for any of the church ladies, or Jane Beaver, or Carol Ann. At trial, GBI agent Rhodes testified there were no particular reasons for this divide. It just hadn't occurred to him to make any recordings of those particular witnesses. Though given how stark the discrepancy is, with almost all defense witnesses recorded, but not a single state witness, it's hard to believe that could be due just to coincidence. The missing audio in this case isn't all the state's doing, though. There were also taped interviews done by the defense investigators, the ones working on Dennis Perry's behalf. But we don't have those either. They did record a lot of interviews during their 3 years of working on the case. We can see that in the reports and the transcripts that were made of those recordings. But somehow, over the past 18 years, those recordings have been lost. Some were made by defense investigator Ben Parks, but he passed away several years ago. Best we can tell, his recordings in the case were thrown out after he died. And some were made by investigator John Bradley, but no one seems to know now where those might have ended up. So those recordings, too, are no longer available.
And that brings us to Butch Kennedy's cassette tapes, a collection of witness interviews that were recorded and would be available to us now if only they hadn't gone missing years ago. Here's what we know about those tapes. They were made on a handheld recorder with multiple different witnesses included in each tape. Basically, Butch Kennedy would start an interview on one tape and keep going with new interviews until that tape was filled up, and then he'd start a new tape. The very first recording for this case should begin as Butch Kennedy arrived at Rising Daughter on the night that Harold and Thelma Swain were killed. Kennedy recorded just a monologue of what he saw, what he did, who he talked to, stream of consciousness style. And that first tape should also include the very first statements that were given by some of the church witnesses that night, as they were speaking to Deputy Kennedy in the Rising Daughter churchyard, not even 2 hours after the murders had taken place. Butch Kennedy remembers making those recordings, though there are no documents now that reflect their existence. And then we have two stray pages of handwritten notes that are tucked into a pile of other case records. And those two pages give us another clue about what the contents of those tapes may have been. Those handwritten notes provide an index of sorts, for at least some of the Kennedy recordings anyway. There must have been at least four tapes, because tapes W, X, Y, and Z are listed there. And for each tape, there's a list of people who were interviewed on it. Most of the names listed there are names that I recognize, and many of those interviews we actually do have transcripts for, but not all of them. And some of the names I barely recognize, or don't recognize at all. Names like Ann Spradley, Lori Ann, Randa Clements, and Henry Middleton. I'm still not sure why Butch Kennedy would have been speaking to them about this case, and no transcripts of those interviews are in the file. And without those records, it's not clear we'll ever know what these interviews were really about.
I have spent much of my adult life thinking what I wouldn't do to get a good night's sleep. Believe me, I've tried all kinds of things. I've tried sleep aids and melatonin and nature sounds. And I'm not even kidding. The list goes on and on. But I finally figured it out. What I needed was Boll & Branch sheets, because everything that Boll & Branch makes, from their bedding to their blankets, is from 100% organic cotton. They start out super soft, and they just get softer over time, which sounds kind of crazy, but it actually does happen. And you buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Now, if you've ever bought luxury sheets, you know they can cost up to $1,000 in the store. I mean, a grand for sheets. But Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple of $100, and everybody who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. I love them, my husband loves them, my cats, my kids, everybody loves them. That's why everybody's always in our bed. And that's also why they have thousands of five-star reviews. From Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company, everybody is talking about Boll & Branch. Apparently, even three U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch sheets. Now, that's a heck of an endorsement. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. Try the sheets for 30 nights. Think about that. Can you do that anywhere else? No, you can't. If you don't love them, send them back for a refund, but you're not going to want to send them back. You're going to want to wash them and put them right back on, or get yourself another pair so you can just switch them right out. They come gorgeously packaged. I'm not kidding. I felt like I was unwrapping a gift. And by the way, they also make a great gift. So to get you started right now, our listeners can get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com using the promo code undisclosed. Go to bollandbranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's boll, B-O-L-L, and branch.com, promo code undisclosed. Once again, bollandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed.
But it's at least possible the original audio recordings of these interviews still exist today, and that Butch Kennedy's tape cassettes are currently tucked away on a random shelf somewhere in Camden County, just waiting to be found. After all, it seems unlikely that either the sheriff's office or the DA's office would have intentionally destroyed something like that. It's possible they did for whatever reason, but it's also possible they'd just been misplaced somehow. So when Susan spoke to Butch Kennedy, one of the goals was to figure out any possible leads on where those tapes might have ended up. She asked him about anything and everything he could recall about his records from the case, how they were kept, and where they were stored, in the hopes he may be able to provide some clues as to where those tape cassettes might be now.
It's all in one vault. I had an office behind the sheriff's office, the new sheriff's office, and it was an old state small mobile home. And they said, you know, yeah, it's been sitting out there for so long, so you guys can have it. You can do what you want to. So I took it for an office. And I had a desk at this end of it. And over here was where a huge generator was. And it was in a box, a huge box. and that box was stayed on top of that generator, so it was easy to go through, easy to get to, and I could just do what I had to do.
And Butch Kennedy believed the taped interviews ought to still be in that box, wherever it might be.
There were transcripts that were made, so we have those, okay. And not the audio.
But then the tapes are still there.
The tape's been gone. I think the whole box went away.
That box contained leads from Unsolved Mysteries.
We still have those, so why did the tapes go away?
We
have those. Okay. Those are still there.
But why the Unsolved Mysteries lead sheets are still around today and the taped interviews are not is something Butch Kennedy could not explain. The tapes were there when he was fired and left the sheriff's office, and that's all he knows about what happened to them.
These missing recordings were also an issue at Dennis Perry's trial. In his opening statement, defense attorney Dale Wessling went through a litany of all the evidence in this case that no longer existed. All the things and records and photos that, as of 2003, had gone missing. And so were all the things that Deputy Dale Bundy, in his reopening of the investigation, had never had an opportunity to see for himself. The defense was trying to make it clear for the jury that, hey, something is wrong here. This isn't normal. All this evidence that the state somehow can't find? That's not how it's supposed to work. And so, Dale Wessling told the jury,
Detective Bundy will testify that to this day, he has never seen the photo spread that Joe Gregory showed. He's never seen the photographs of the lineup that Ms. Van Zola witnessed or looked at. He has no idea where that Pepsi bottle is. He would tell you he has no idea where the glasses are, where the taped interviews are of all the witnesses 1 hour after the commission of the crime. He don't know where they are.
And this part of the defense's opening statement is why, during the trial, Prosecutor John Johnson made a point of showing the jury that, in fact, transcripts of those recorded interviews did exist and were available. Because during his direct examination of Butch Kennedy, John Johnson asked him about the written transcripts. And apparently, while doing so, he was waving about copies of these transcripts and making sure the jury saw them. He didn't actually introduce these transcripts into evidence or anything like that. He just held up copies of them while talking about them, so the jury would be sure to know that they existed and were available. Defense counsel objected.
Judge, I'm not quite sure what the purpose of showing the detective the alleged typed transcript without introducing it is, but I'm going to object. He hasn't offered them, but he's getting a whole lot of mileage out by just saying, hey, were they typed? And holding them and walking them back to the podium.
Well, Judge, I regret the counsel doesn't understand why that's been done, because apparently he didn't listen to his own opening when he talked extensively about these interview tapes being missing. I've got a right to show that while they may be missing, we do have memorialized contents of those. What defense counsel wants to be able to do, Judge, is he wants to be able to say that these tapes are missing, and there's nothing out there that we can have that can show what these ladies said, and he's raised that issue in his opening. I've got a right to show what was done.
In other words, John Johnson wanted to prove to the jury that even if the tape recordings were missing, there were still transcripts made of those interviews. So it wasn't as if any evidence had truly been lost. It was still recorded, just in written form. It was as if John Johnson was trying to tell the jury, see, we still know what the witnesses said here. There was nothing lost. No harm, no foul. It's not really that big a deal that we don't have the audio for these tapes. But it was a big deal, and we don't have the transcripts for all those recordings that Butch Kennedy made. And the loss of those tapes represents a real loss of data that we can't get back now. Take, for instance, that very first recording that Butch Kennedy made, the one of him walking around Rising Daughter and recording his observations. Because due to the loss of many of the original police reports and photographs, we don't actually know now where much of that physical evidence was located at the crime scene. Butch Kennedy's tapes might have been able to fill in those gaps in our knowledge. Some of that information might not have been all that important, like, for instance, the location of the cigarette butts that were found in the churchyard and are depicted in some of the photographs. Sure, maybe the killer left those there, but they could have just as easily come from someone else. And anyway, they were never collected, so any evidentiary value is gone now. But then there were the two Pepsi bottles, or Pepsi cans, it's not clear which, that were found somewhere near the church. It seems like photos of those were taken because I've had witnesses describe them to me, but the photos are gone now, and it's not clear where exactly the Pepsis were found. But those Pepsis were collected, and if they still exist today, could be a source of DNA evidence in this case. And there's reason to think those Pepsis were connected to the crime. Plus, there are other photos of the crime scene that we do have, but that depict items that are not recorded in any written reports, and we're left now just to wonder about. Things that Butch Kennedy's tapes might have given us more context for. For instance, one of the crime scene photos is an out-of-focus shot of the churchyard, showing a fuzzy image of a teal and yellow branded bag that looks like it once contained some kind of snack, probably. I couldn't figure out what it was at first. It didn't seem like any brand of snack food I'd ever seen before. So I posted it on Twitter, and I quickly learned that while a lot of people also had no idea what it was, to a large segment of the U.S. population, primarily in the Northeast, it was instantly recognizable. It was a Wise potato chips bag, a brand primarily distributed up north. But if the investigators were as puzzled by the bag as I was, or also thought it was a brand that might not have been so common locally, there's no mention of it in the files. So maybe it didn't seem out of the ordinary to them.
One of the transcripts we do have is from Butch Kennedy's interview with a woman named Lottie Bell Clayton. And actually, that transcript is the only thing we know about her and what she had to say. Nothing that Lottie Bell Clayton told Butch Kennedy is referenced anywhere else in the available files. Which seems odd, because what Lottie Bell Clayton had to say seems like it had a potential to have been hugely important. Because Lottie Bell Clayton told Butch Kennedy that at Sunday service the week before the Swains were killed, she had spoken to a white man with shaggy blonde hair who had come to Rising Daughter. And Lottie Bell Clayton said he'd told her he wanted to speak to someone inside the church.
Did the man say anything to you?
Well, he said he lived here in Woodbine. Said he'd like to talk to the pastor.
He didn't call him by name?
No, he didn't call him by name. Just said he'd like to talk to the pastor. So, me and my daughter, we're ushers, you know. We met him at the door. And so, we went and told our pastor that, he wanted to see him. So, they went back to the pastor's study in the back there. But, what he told Reverend Strickland, I don't know, but his wife said he wanted to borrow $20 from him, see, pay him back. So he said her husband did. Reverend Strickland did give him the $20.
What Lottie Bell Clayton described in her interview with Butch Kennedy seems like an eerie foreshadowing of the events that would take place at Rising Daughter just 1 week later. A white man with longish blonde hair appeared on Rising Daughter's doorstep and stopped a woman he'd encountered there. He told her he wanted to speak to the man in charge, though he didn't exactly say the man's name, just indicated him by description. The similarities between Lottie Bell Clayton's story and Van Zola Williams' story raise an obvious question. Was the man that Lottie spoke to at Rising Daughter on March 3rd the same man that Van Zola encountered there on March 11th? If they were the same man, that would have serious implication for Dennis's case, because there are no suggestions from any of the witnesses that Dennis Perry was in Waverly 2 weekends in a row. But Lottie Bell Clayton died in 1989, and her daughter, who also spoke to the young white man, died in 2003. There's no way now to ask them for more information about that young white man, or whether they had ever had any reason to believe he was somehow connected to the Swain case. But after speaking to Lottie Bell Clayton and her daughter, the obvious next witness to speak to about all this would have been Reverend Bethel Strickland. And that appears to be exactly what Butch Kennedy did. Because in the handwritten index of Butch Kennedy's tapes, the very next name that appears after Lottie Bell Clayton is Reverend Bethel Strickland.
So I found this. Is that your handwriting? What I think that is a record of the tape she would have made.
Sammy, I know, is the one that saw the car.
You have a transcript of that.
Franklin is dead.
Mm-hmm.
Bethel Strickland.
I don't know who she is.
Him. Bethel is a... Is
oh,
a
him.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's still alive.
Oh, that was the pastor.
Presumably, Butch Kennedy interviewed Bethel Strickland about what Lottie Bell Clayton had said in her interview. But that's just a guess. There's no record anywhere about what Reverend Strickland actually told Butch Kennedy, and Butch Kennedy doesn't remember now what that interview is about. And Reverend Bethel Strickland and his wife both passed away many years ago, so there's no way to ask them about it now. Which means we're left with no clear way of knowing what all of this may have been about, and no clear way of knowing whether the blind man who spoke to Lottie Bell Clayton was just a random drifter in need of a handout, or whether he might have in some way been connected to the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain.
Another witness who may have been recorded on Butch Kennedy's tapes is Leona Hamilton Reed. On the night of the shootings at Rising Daughter Baptist Church, she'd been working at the Reed store, there on the corner of US 17 and Dover Bluff Road. And she'd been there when Margie Moore had come in, after fleeing from the church. Leona had been the one to call 911 to report the shooting. And Leona Reed may have also been an eyewitness in this case. But the important part of Leona Reed's story is not what she'd seen after the shooting, when Margie Moore came into the store, but what she'd seen before, at about 8:16 p.m. that evening. Because that's the exact time, according to the cash register tape, that Leona Reed had sold a Pepsi to a white man with collar-length blonde hair. We do know Leona Reed was interviewed several times, and we do at least have reports from law enforcement officials about these interviews. And her name also appears in the handwritten notes alongside the names of other witnesses whom Butch Kennedy recorded, which suggests that an interview with Leona Reed may have been among the ones that were recorded by Butch Kennedy. Leona Reed passed away some years ago, but Cynthia Clayton, the Swain's niece, remembers talking to her about what she'd seen that night.
I also heard, and the person who worked at Reed that night is deceased as well.
Leona?
That he was up at the store that night to the point where, he scared her. And I think she even called someone to say how she was feeling. And then I had also heard that she had sold him some Pepsi Cola.
Cynthia Clayton thought the man Leona Reed had seen that night had been Dennis Perry, but Leona Reed never identified the man. She told police that she hadn't known who he was. The rest of Cynthia's story is right, though. The day after the shootings, she was interviewed by a GBI agent, and she told him about the customer who'd come into the store the night before. He was a white male, late 20s or early 30s, 5'6 to 5'8, approximately 150 pounds, with blonde, collar-length hair that was a little bit darker on top and lighter at the ends. He had thick, dark eyebrows and was wearing thick, dark glasses and was driving an orange or burnt orange Plymouth-type vehicle. The man had come into the store and asked if they'd sold Coca-Cola, and she told him yes, and he'd bought a Pepsi. The total cost was 55 cents. The man had pulled two quarters out of his shirt pocket and given them to her, but then for the last 5 cents, he'd had to go back to his car and rummage around for some change. Leona Reed remembered him dropping the pennies into her hand, one by one, counting them out. And then the man had left, heading south on US 17 in an older Plymouth-type vehicle. And according to a report that Bundy had written in 1998, Leona Reed had identified the man's car not just by sight, but also by sound. Because based on the noise the starter had made, she thought the car had been an older Chrysler. And, like Cynthia Clayton said, Leona Reed had been scared of the man. It wasn't that there'd been anything overtly threatening or all that strange about him necessarily, but for some reason that Leona couldn't quite put into words, his presence had made her uneasy. From the time he entered the store until the time he left, she'd been worried that the man was planning to rob her. In the end, he hadn't, though. He'd just bought his Pepsi, paid his 55 cents, and he'd been on his way. And that's probably all we'll know about what Leona Reed saw that night. She was subpoenaed by the state for Dennis Perry's trial, but she was never called to testify. And it's hard not to wonder if that's because her story does nothing to point to Dennis Perry's guilt, and would seem to be strong circumstantial evidence of his innocence. Leona hadn't recognized the man, and her description of him doesn't match Dennis. He was shorter, with longer blonder hair and thick glasses. And the man had been driving a car, something Dennis Perry didn't have. That's why, after all, the state had argued that Dennis Perry had ridden a motorcycle to get down to Camden County. Besides, Dennis only lived four doors down from the Reed store. If he was going to go there, he would have walked. And Leona Reed was not the only witness at the Reed store who may have seen the suspect in a Chrysler that night. That evening, a man named Sammy Williams had driven up US 17 on his way to the Reed store, and as he passed by Rising Daughter, he noticed what he thought was a car broken down on the side of the road. The only reason we even know this is that Butch Kennedy interviewed him, and this was one of the interviews that got transcribed. And, according to the transcript, Sammy Williams told Deputy Kennedy,
"I was coming by here, going to the store. I noticed a brown, either a Plymouth Valiant or Dodge Dart, something like that. I wouldn't say a real dark brown, just kind of a faded brown. It's an old model car, maybe, around about a 68 or 70 model, something like that, something between there. But I noticed it sitting there on the side of the road, and I just had this funny feeling, and said, well, shoot, somebody broke down here. I know when I came by earlier, there wasn't nothing there, but when I came back by to go to the store again, there's this car on the side of the road. I said, darn, this car done broke down, right in front of the church."
Sammy Williams passed by the car and headed on to the Reed store. He was still there when Margie Moore pulled up, frantic, and telling them about what had happened at the church. Sammy Williams immediately thought about the car he'd seen on his way to the store. He told Butch Kennedy,
"I knew when I'm hearing that, knowing that I seen this car on the other side of the road, I said, let me go back down there and see if this darn car is still down here. So I jumped in my little pickup, and right on back I came, wide open, you know. And when I came back by, the car was gone. Anyway, like I say, it was sitting on the southbound side, head south."
So when Sammy Williams went back to check after learning of the shooting, the strange brown car had been gone, which, to Sammy Williams, had meant the car hadn't been broken down at all, because in the time he'd been at the store, there hadn't been enough time for someone to have fixed the car or to have gotten gas for it. And if Sammy Williams is right, if he did see a car outside of Rising Daughter on his way to the Reed store that evening, and that it was gone when he went back to check on it after the shooting, it seems possible that the reason the car was gone is that the killer had driven it away.
About 30 minutes after Camden County's 911 dispatch received Leona Reed's call reporting the shooting at Rising Daughter, another call was made to law enforcement in Nassau County, Florida, about a 30-minute drive south from Rising Daughter. That call came in from a Shell station in the little town of Yulee, just off Highway 17, the same highway that Rising Daughter is on. The caller was the gas station attendant, and she reported a drive off. A man in a yellow Plymouth or Dodge had filled up his tank and driven off without paying. The man was slender, with light-colored hair, and had what the gas station attendant described as a regular haircut. He had on dark clothes and may have been wearing glasses. And at least for a little while, this made investigators wonder if the killer had fled to the Florida aft. An article published a few days after the murders quoted Sheriff Bill Smith as saying they believed the drive-off from the gas station could be connected to the murders.
Sheriff Smith said that authorities have not eliminated the possibility that a suspect who stole gasoline in a drive-off theft at a station near I-95 and U.S. Highway 17 about an hour after the shootings could be connected to the case. "We may have that suspect already identified," said the sheriff.
Based on the GBI files, the suspect that Sheriff Smith was referencing seems to have been a man named Michael Vernon Platt. A few days after the drive-off, the woman who had been working at the Shell station and who had made the 911 call to report the drive-off had been shown a picture of Platt, and she said he looked like the man who had done the drive-off. Michael Vernon Platt was 5'7", 150 pounds, with blonde hair and blue eyes. He drove a 1968 or 1969 yellowish Plymouth. Based on this admittedly skimpy detail that investigators were going on at the time, Platt seems like he might have been a strong match. But if investigators did anything more to follow up in the lead, it's not recorded anywhere. As far as the available records in the Swain case file are concerned, the drive-off in Yulee, Florida was just another potential lead that was considered, but never followed up on.
In addition to Leona Reed and Sammy Williams, there's one more witness outside of Rising Daughter Baptist who may have seen the killer's car that night. Although this witness, at least, we can be sure was not recorded on any of Butch Kennedy's tapes. The only reason I even know about Paul Robertson is because of a one-page, handwritten statement that was tucked away in the DA's case file. The statement was dated March 12, 1985, the day after the murders. And the statement surprised me because I'd never seen Paul Robertson's name before in any of the investigative files. And that seemed odd, because based on that one-page statement, it seemed like Paul Robertson ought to have been one of the more important witnesses in this case. And yet there's no other mention of Paul Robertson anywhere in the police file. So I started to think that maybe, for some reason that wasn't clear, the police must have determined that Paul Robertson's statement wasn't as relevant as it appeared at first glance. On its face, though, the statement seemed credible. And I found out later that Paul Robertson had actually worked for the sheriff's office at one time, though by 1985, he'd left for a new job. I asked Butch Kennedy about it to see what he might recall, and although Butch Kennedy did remember Paul Robertson, he did not remember ever seeing a statement from Paul Robertson in connection with the Swain case.
Do you remember Paul Robertson? I can read it for you. You do?
Mm-hmm.
What about him do you remember?
Paul worked with the sheriff's office. He was a deputy.
So he was driving back from church that night about the right time, at 9:15. He was on US 17. And he saw a car that he thought was someone drunk. It ran at the edge of the pavement twice in less than a fourth of a mile.
Paul Robertson's statement describes how, about a half mile south of Rising Daughter Baptist Church, he'd come up behind another car. And while Robertson didn't positively ID the car's make, he described it as something like an early 70s Pontiac Catalina. The car was driving erratically and going about 10 to 15 miles slower than the normal speed of traffic for that stretch of highway. Robertson's first thought was that it was a drunk driver, based on how the car had trouble staying in its lane. So Robertson passed the car, and as he did, he saw a bare arm stuck outside the driver's side window. The hand was covering the outside rear mirror, as if the driver was trying to shield against the glare of Robertson's headlights. Based on the hand and arm, though, Robertson guessed that the driver was a white male less than 30 years old. Robertson continued south on Highway 17, and approximately 6 minutes later, he passed a Woodbine City police car that was headed north, its blue lights on. That would have been Officer Buddy Miller, responding to the call from Leona Reed reporting the shooting at Rising Daughter. And while Paul Robertson couldn't have known it at the time of his report, the timing and locations described in the statement would have meant that he passed by that erratic driver about a half mile south of Rising Daughter Baptist, just minutes after Margie Moore had grabbed her broom and made a brave dash for the Reed store. Paul Robertson had thought that the driver of that car might have been drunk. But based on his description, I wonder if there might be another explanation here. Because the slow speed, the weaving driving, and the attempt to shield the blinding glare of the headlights, well, that could have been a drunk driver. Or it could have been someone who was having trouble seeing the road. So, why was Robertson's report not mentioned anywhere else in the police file? Butch Kennedy wasn't sure, but based on what he knew of Paul Robertson, he seemed to take the statement seriously.
He would have probably have noticed that with the law enforcement experience that he had, it might have been, you know.
It makes this sound more reliable, because he would be someone who would be looking for that kind of thing and would be paying attention to that kind of thing.
From what Butch Kennedy told me, there was no reason not to take Paul Robertson's statement seriously. So the next day, GIP intern Ed Kostikian and I went to his house and knocked on his door, hoping to ask him about it. But I wasn't sure if Paul Robertson would have any idea what we were talking about or why we were there, because it seemed very possible that, after all this time, he might not recall some brief statement he'd made and written out one day 33 years ago. I didn't need to worry, though, because I didn't even hardly have time to finish my question before he'd known instantly what I was there for. Paul Robertson definitely recalled making that statement, and 3 decades later, he was still upset that no one had ever come to talk to him about it. Paul Robertson didn't want to be quoted for the podcast, because he didn't think he had anything to add to a statement beyond what he'd written back then in 1985. His memory of the incident at the time he made that statement was undoubtedly better than it was now, after all. But there was one thing that he agreed to be quoted on. He told me, "You can say that I wouldn't talk to you about the statement, because no one at the sheriff's office ever cared about it when I turned it in. So there's no need in talking to you about it now. And I don't care if they know that. I'll tell them that to their faces. No one was interested in what I saw. No one ever talked to me about the written statement I turned in. No one ever questioned me. No one ever elaborated on it. You're the first to ever ask me about it in 33 years.
After talking to Paul Robertson, Ed and I had a similar reaction.
They fucked up.
Really
good. Maybe it's not relevant, but there's a good chance it is. A really good chance.
On March 12th, 1985, after learning of the murders at Rising Daughter, Paul Barberson thought that what he'd seen the night before, outside on the highway driving home, might be important to the case. And so he'd taken the initiative to write up the statement himself and gone down to the sheriff's office to hand it in. And then, after that, he'd never heard anything more about it. I still have no idea what happened to his statement or why it was never followed up on. When I showed it to Butch Kennedy, he couldn't recall ever seeing it before, and his reaction had been that Paul Robertson was a credible witness, so I don't understand why he wouldn't have looked into it back in 1985. What is clear, though, is that the reason Paul Robertson's statement had been ignored is not that it had been discredited in some way, because it hadn't been. It had just never been checked out at all. And I think that there's a very strong chance that what Paul Robertson saw that night was not a drunk driver. It was someone who was driving erratically because they'd been half-blinded after losing their glasses.
Butch Kennedy's tapes aren't the only recordings from the initial investigation that have now gone missing. In fact, once upon a time, there existed a recording of a man confessing to the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain. One day short of a year after Harold and Thelma Swain had been murdered, in March of 1986, Deputy Dale Bundy got a call on the case that at first seemed like the strongest lead investigators had received in a while. The caller told Kennedy that for the past few months, his daughter's ex-husband, a man named Eric Sparr, had been calling the family and threatening them. Finally, the family started taping the calls, and in one of the calls they recorded, Sparr said, "I'm the motherfucker that killed the two black people in that church, and I'm going to kill you and the whole damn family if I have to do it in church." After hearing the recording of this apparent confession, Deputy Kenny went out to interview the family of Sparr's ex-wife. What Sparr's ex-wife had to say seemed to suggest to Kennedy that finally, he might be on the right track in the investigation after all.
"Sometime from March 9th, 1985 until March 15th, 1985, Eric Sparr left the house in the morning wearing dark clothing. His ex-wife said the next morning he came back wearing only a white t-shirt. She also said that he has and often wears a pair of men's lizard skin boots. She stated that Eric wears glasses and that sometime prior to March, Eric had lost his glasses. She said that Eric got three pairs of glasses from his father, Frederick K. Sparr, who works with an insurance company in Brunswick. He made one pair of glasses from the three he got from his father. She also stated that Eric has worked as a welder and had worked at a trucking service as a mechanic. She described Eric as being in his 20s, and in March 1985, he had shoulder-length brown hair."
If there had been a checklist of the known attributes of the killer at Rising Daughter, the description of Eric Sparr would seem to tick off just about every box. The Frankenstein 3-in-1 glasses, the boots, the missing overshirt that would have been torn off in the shooting, and the white t-shirt underneath that some of the witnesses had seen. Plus, Eric Sparr was a welder and a mechanic, the two professions suggested by the slag marks in the glasses found at the church. And Sparr had shoulder-length brownish hair, not far off from witnesses described. Deputy Kennedy even did a lineup identification of sorts. He took the glasses found at the crime scene, along with two other pairs of glasses that were similar in appearance, and showed them to Sparr's ex-wife, and asked her if they looked similar. She picked out the pair from Rising Daughter and told the investigators, "Eric has a pair that looks just like these." Then the investigators decided to check in the physical resemblance between Eric Sparr and the suspect. They got a mugshot of Sparr, and then they took the composite image and gave it the same hairstyle and mustache to match. And there was a creepy sort of resemblance between the composite and Sparr once the changes to the hair were made. When Susan talked to Agent Joe Gregory, he told her about how this tip they'd received to Eric Sparr had been one of the tips that, at least initially, had seemed very promising.
"Some of them looked pretty good. The old boy that called his girlfriend and claimed, 'Oh, I killed the two, and, you know, I'll kill you and your whole family, blah, blah, blah,' that turned out to be nothing."
The search warrant on Eric Sparr turned up nothing that could link him to the murders at Rising Daughter, and further investigation showed investigators this was not, in fact, the big break they'd been hoping for.
"We found out where he was that night. We found, you know, he took a polygraph test, and, you know, he was just TO'd with his ex-wife and just went off the deep end."
Agent Gregory had obtained time cards for the grocery store where Eric Sparr worked, and they showed that he had been clocked in for an overnight shift on the night of the murders, and had been at the grocery store from 3 p.m. on the afternoon of the 11th until 6 a.m. on the morning of the 12th. And so, Eric Sparr was added to the list of ruled-out suspects in the investigation. It wasn't only the original investigators who looked into Eric Sparr, though. In 1998, as Bundy was developing his case against Dennis Perry, he got a call from a different ex-wife of Eric Sparr. This wasn't the same ex-wife who had made the original report to Kennedy and Gregory back in 1986, but the ex-wife he'd married a year or two later. But the second ex-wife had a similar story to tell, and though, unlike the first ex-wife, she didn't have a recording, she too had heard Sparr confess to the murders at Riding Daughter.
Sparr's ex-wife explained that in 1988, Sparr began arguing with her about dinner not being cooked on time. Sparr pinned her on the bed and placed a pillow over her face. She stated she was screaming, "Don't kill me." She stated she was able to get away from Sparr and told him, "You could have killed those people in Camden County." Sparr replied, "Yeah, I could have killed those people." Sparr's ex-wife described Sparr as being very prejudiced and said he hated black people. She said Sparr was like a white supremacist.
Judging by Sparr's Facebook page today and the 14 words on it, he wasn't just like a white supremacist, he was one. And in 1985, when the warrant was executed in his house, the supporting affidavit described another incident that Sparr had been involved in that seems to suggest he'd been involved in a racially motivated attack.
Prior to the murder, Eric Sparr pulled a long rifle on a black or oriental man at Choo Choo Barbecue in Camden County and threatened his life. During this altercation, he kicked out the windshield of the victim's car.
But despite Sparr's close match to the description of the killer and the potential motive for the killing that might be proved by Sparr's white supremacist ties, after the search warrant on Sparr's house came up empty for any evidence linking him to the murders at Rising Daughter, he was fairly quickly ruled out as a suspect. Any evidence tying him to the crime was not enough to outweigh the alibi evidence in his favor. And Del Bundy told Susan there was also another reason for ruling him out as a possible suspect, one that neither Butch Kennedy nor Joe Gregory had mentioned.
There was a guy over in Charlton County that claimed he killed the Swains, and his wife called up here and says, "Yeah, I think I know who did it. My husband said he went over there and blew their heads off with a shotgun." Well, that's not what happened at all. So what he was trying to do was scare his wife, which this guy did on a regular basis.
I think I know you're talking about. She recorded it, and he actually claimed to her to have killed him.
Yeah, with a shotgun. Blew their heads off with a shotgun.
Yeah, so he was bragging about doing it. Was that to mess with her, you think?
Yeah.
That part about Eric Sparr claiming to have used a shotgun to commit the crimes is not in any of the records we've seen, though. There is a report about Sparr firing a shotgun at his ex-wife's house, but there's nothing in there about Sparr claiming to have committed the shootings at Rising Daughter with a shotgun. And it's possible that Del Bundy is conflating these two details in his memory now, which would be an understandable sort of thing to remember wrong when talking to Susan 20 years after all this happened. But it doesn't seem like we'll ever know now. The tape of Eric Sparr's confession is missing, along with all the rest of the recordings made during the original investigation, so there's no way to know if there's anything else that Sparr said in the confession that would tend to discredit it. In addition to the tape-recorded statement of Eric Sparr's call to his ex-wife, there were other one-time suspects in this case that Butch Kennedy had recorded interviews with. Suspects like, for instance, Toby Heyman. All other records related to this particular suspect have been lost, but Butch Kennedy interviewed him twice and then made handwritten transcripts of the interview. And those transcripts, while hard to read, are still in the DA's case file. Now, at least for this particular suspect, it doesn't appear the recording of Butch Kennedy's interview with him was all that interesting, or that much of value has been lost by not having an actual recording available. And calling Toby Heyman a suspect is a bit of a stretch. Although we don't have any of the other records that could help put together the full picture of how or why Toby Heyman came to be a possible suspect in the Swain case, the handwritten transcripts let us fill in the gaps about what might have happened. Apparently everyone who knew Toby Heyman seemed to think he looked like the composite image of the suspect from Rising Daughter, so it was just a matter of time before someone had called his name into the police. Toby Heyman had told Butch Kennedy that he'd known investigators were bound to drop in sooner or later to interview him because everyone around him kept telling him he looked like the killer. He couldn't even go down to the store without people making fun of him for it. He even drove a brown car like the killer supposedly had driven. In fact, right after the shooting happened, his wife had seen the initial reports and become concerned about how much it sounded like her husband. So she'd immediately called him up at work. There had been a shooting up in Woodbine, she'd said, and the description of the shooter fits you to a T. And as Toby Heyman told Butch Kennedy and Joe Gregory, That's the reason he'd been ready with a well-researched alibi when they'd shown up to interview him, because he'd figured that eventually someone would report him as a possible suspect in the case based upon his resemblance to the composite image and the general description of the killer provided by witnesses. So he'd already gone ahead and figured out exactly where he'd been the night of the murders, and who could vouch for where he'd been, and had his alibi ready for the investigators when they showed up on his doorstep. And while we don't have any records showing that Gregory or Kennedy followed up on anything that Toby Heyman said in this interview, his alibi must have checked out, because there's not another mention of Toby Heyman anywhere in the remaining case file.
But there were other suspects interviewed by Butch Kennedy too, and the recordings of those interviews were on those tapes. And for some of those suspects, it's far from clear why they were ruled out in the first place. Take, for instance, a guy I'm going to call Kevin. Of all the suspects that have ever been identified in this case, Kevin is the only one we know of that could have worn the glasses found in the vestibule at Rising Daughter Baptist Church and had his vision be improved rather than made worse. Kevin was farsighted, and though doctor's records show that his prescription was even stronger than the glasses that were found at Rising Daughter, he had a similar right eye astigmatism. And Kevin was a short, slender white man with shoulder-length blonde hair who drove a Pontiac Catalina and owned a .25 caliber weapon. And when he was interviewed by Butch Kennedy and Joe Gregory, he apparently lied to them about his alibi for March 11, 1985. Something we only know about because there are notes from a later interview with Kevin's girlfriend, where she breaks down crying when she's confronted with the fact that Kevin had used her as a witness that could verify the bad alibi he'd given the police. And Kevin's father also told investigators that the alibi Kevin had given them hadn't been true. But even though Butch Kennedy recorded at least one of his interviews with Kevin, as well as at least one interview with another alibi witness who could supposedly corroborate Kevin's alibi, we don't know what exactly Kevin told the police about where he'd been that night, or whether there was any reason to think that his bad alibi had just been due to a simple mistake of memory, because no transcripts were ever prepared for any of those interviews. Or, if they were, they're gone now. From the records we do have, though, I have to assume that Kevin eventually came up with an alibi that did check out, because, for some reason or another, he was dropped as a suspect. But it sure would be nice to know why exactly investigators decided that he was not the guy they were looking for. So, there are a lot of things in this case that Butch Kennedy's missing tape cassettes might help resolve. But even without a magic wand that can bring back lost evidence, I'm hopeful that those tapes are still out there somewhere and might still be found today. Because in the GBI's files from this case, there's one entry from May 8, 2001 that suggests there's at least someone out there who knows exactly where those tapes are now. In the May 8th GBI memo, Agent Ron Rhodes wrote,
"On Tuesday, May 8th, 2001, at approximately 3 p.m., ASIC John Heinen and Special Agent Ron Rhodes located a box containing documents related to this investigation. Agent Rhodes reviewed the documents, which appear to be printouts from the Unsolved Mysteries show, and documents from police agencies around the United States who mailed in information about possible suspects, notes taken down by investigators who previously worked on this case, and a cassette tape containing interviews of witnesses."
So, a box of documents from the original investigators, with printouts from Unsolved Mysteries, and a cassette tape containing witness interviews. In other words, that's exactly how Butch Kennedy described to me the location of his tape cassettes, and where they'd been when he'd last seen them. And in May of 2001, 16 months after Dennis Perry's arrest, and 21 months before his trial, it seems like GBI agent Rhodes and another GBI agent found that box, with at least one of the cassette tapes still in it. And at least some of the contents of that box did make their way into the Swain case file, because the DA's office has the printouts from Unsolved Mysteries. They're still there today, and back before Dennis's trial, those documents were given to his defense attorneys, so they're in the defense file too. But that cassette tape, the one that Agent Rhodes' memo describes as containing recordings of witness interviews, well, if that is Butch Kennedy's tape, the official word from the DA's office is that it doesn't exist. Although the GBI memo doesn't state exactly what that tape cassette was, based on the known chain of custody of the GBI's own tape recordings from the case, and based on the date and location of where this one was found, well, the record strongly indicates that this cassette was not one of the GBI's, and it was not from the reopened investigation. And that would mean that the only other thing it could be is one of Butch Kennedy's recordings. I have no idea, though, if Agent Rose recalls now finding this box of evidence, or if he recalls what happened to this cassette tape. He works for the ATF now, and when I talked to him, he told me that he didn't think he could speak to me about Dennis's case because the ATF wouldn't allow it. He did tell me that he'd check with the ATF to be sure and let me know what they said, but so far, he's never responded to any of my attempts to follow up with them about what he might know. So, I have no idea if the ATF granted him permission to talk to me or not, and I have no idea if he still recalls what happened to this tape. But that tape still existed in 2001, and I remain optimistic that it still exists today. It's just a matter now of finding out what shelf it's been waiting on all these years. Thanks for listening to Episode 7 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Dennis Perry. We'll be back on Thursday with an addendum episode, so send us your questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. Mithal Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo is designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Audio production is by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media, and the host of the Crime Writers On podcast. You can find case-related materials, timelines of key events, and witness charts on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. Transcripts of this episode and past episodes are available on our website and are prepared by our transcribing team, Retta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Logus, and Skylar Park. And thanks so much to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Don't forget to follow us online. On all our social media accounts, our handle is @undisclosedpod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Dennis Perry's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.